Good morning. Our first case this morning is A21-1519. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Varesebo versus McKinnon. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just step up to the podium, adjust it to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Valerie Arnold, and I am appearing on behalf of the appellant, Antoine Varesebo, who is also present today. This case involves a dissolution of marriage action. It involves claims of trial court error on a broad range of issues, from child custody and parenting time to spousal support to property division. Although these issues are distinct and follow distinct statutory guidelines, in their analysis, appellant would submit that there is a pattern in this case in terms of the types of errors that were committed by the district court. When we look at the types of errors that appellant has alleged, there are errors of an abuse of discretion by making findings that are unsupported by the evidence, abuse of discretion by failing to consider evidence on material points, and then errors of law because...
On those two, are you talking about the Diamond and the Wells Fargo account? The failure to consider evidence, or just asking you to be able, which ones?
Certainly, and so there are different ones for each area. With respect to the property division, there's certainly the omitted asset of the $45,000, omitted asset of the Diamond. There are also just missing findings because there is a requirement of specific findings. The court shall value the assets, and in particular, if there's a disproportionate allocation, as there was in this case, the court would need to explain its reasoning on that. The missing findings and findings unsupported by the evidence, if I may, I would like to start by touching upon the critical issues of child custody and parenting time. When we look at the district court's findings in this case, the findings are riddled with errors and omissions. And the errors are ones where the court is applying fault to appellant in its analysis when the findings are inaccurate. An example of this would be the court's heavy reliance on Mr. Varesebo's proposal of supervised parenting time for a couple of hours. The fact of the matter is, his proposal was for a 5225 schedule. That is what he proposed. When we look at the case law that talks about what is the line between a district court's exercise of discretion and an abuse of discretion, the case law is informative. The Weatherly case, for example, talks about reversible error in that case when the court disregarded or dismissed evidence that reflected negatively on one party. When the court disregarded evidence that favored the other party, and when the district court made findings against the weight of the evidence. The rogue...
Can I ask you, on the custody, I'm having a bit of a hard time understanding your definition of error, because they're factors, they're fact-specific, And of course, we look at it by giving deference in favor of the district court's findings. And so the impression I get in looking at the record, the party certainly exuberantly, should we say, disagreed and presented opposing evidence to the judge, who then had to make findings regarding the best interest factors. And how do we, so you give examples of ignoring evidence. Would it be better to say perhaps the court, at least implicitly in those situations, didn't find it useful or helpful to analyze any one of those particular factors? So that, in a nutshell, in other words, it appears to me that your client wants us to reweigh, which of course we don't do, as opposed to giving deference to the district court.
Thank you for that question, because that really hits the heart of the case here. This appeal isn't about asking the court to reconcile disputed issues of fact. This is about actual error. And so, for example, an example would be the district court's findings with respect to domestic violence. The court indicated that it would not relitigate domestic violence. It had made findings that respondents' claims were not credible. Were not credible to the point of the court really almost concluding she was just lying.
But, I mean, you're right, absolutely. But when you say that district court sort of ignored the findings of domestic abuse, it was my understanding all the OFPs were denied.
Correct.
Okay. And so I viewed that more as a discussion of credibility as opposed to, you know, well, I agree there was domestic violence by, you know, father or mother. Why am I wrong, Ms. Arnold?
So, Your Honor, the statutory factor under 518.17 is whether or not domestic abuse occurred, not whether or not an OFP was issued. And so that's an important distinction. The issue of domestic violence, though, is critical in this case because the trial court, first of all, hangs its hat in large part on the custody evaluator's findings and recommendations. The custody evaluator, in her findings, I think it might have been page 12 of her report, Exhibit 5, page 23 of Exhibit 5. In her analysis, she found it troubling that there were pending criminal charges. She found respondents' allegations of domestic violence compelling. She testified during trial that if there were false allegations of abuse, that was a material issue for her. She testified that if there was chronic lying, chronic misrepresentation, that impacted not only the parenting time itself, but her analysis on legal custody. So when the court chooses to ignore these findings. So one is factor four, whether or not there's been domestic violence. But the lying about domestic violence is critical here. It impacts every aspect of parenting time. It impacts every aspect of legal custody. And so the court ignored that information. Not only that, when we look at the type of reversible error in the Weatherly case, that's what we see here. So, for example, my client is chronically blamed for making statements that respondent has mental health issues. First of all, that's a statement that's supported by evidence in the record. Another example where the trial court failed to look at the testimony of the neutral expert, Dr. King. The lack of transparency in that neutral evaluation, which included IQ testing, the neutral evaluator indicated that the level of dishonesty or the difference between respondent who has a master's degree and the person who appeared for testing was someone with an intellectual deficit, could be explained by traumatic brain injury, right? One would expect impediments not only in cognitive thinking, but in speech, ignored by the judge. And so when we rely on a custody evaluation, we have to consider the evidence that happened at trial. We have to consider, for example, when the trial court faults Mr. Varsebo for claiming that there was no there was parental alienation, Ms. Rowler's testimony said that he did present evidence of parental alienation, and she corrected what she wrote in the report, and she said you don't have to have contact resistance in order for there to be parental alienation. So when we look at what was not considered, so it's not a matter of him saying Dr. King's testimony about respondent isn't important to me, or I don't believe he was credible. This is unrefuted testimony. The findings of credibility are this court's, the trial court's own findings of credibility. When we have a trial court faulting appellant for saying that mom has mental health issues, and we don't consider that mom has made chronic and repeated false allegations of domestic abuse, that's the problem in Weatherly, where the parents are treated disparately. Another example of that.
I understand that your point, Ms. Arnold, but you know, in going through the factors, well, ultimately, it seemed to me the district court the district court also sort of focused on, for better or worse, you know, the 17 calls your client was making to the police, the whole kindergarten issue. Ultimately, in going through the factors and making its determination on custody, it seems like the district court, which we have seen before, saying, you know, these people are just not going to be able to deal with each other on custody, so I'm going to do this. That's something we've seen before, and that's something we've affirmed. So in this instance, when there seems to be evidence on both sides, how is it so clear that the district court's decision on sole custody was clearly erroneous and not supported by the evidence?
Well, to the point of the examples just cited by the court here, there weren't 17 calls. Okay. So that would be an example. There were 8 or 9. There was duplication in that. And so many of the findings that the court relied upon weren't factual. And that's where we run into error. Another example of disparate treatment, for example, in looking at the parenting time schedule. The district court found that giving dad more time would be a reduction to mom and would make mom look bad in the eyes of the child. The court didn't look at the drastic reduction in parenting time for dad and how that would impact the eyes of the child.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Essen.
Well, Ms. Arnold, just with the time remaining, I wanted to turn to a couple of the other issues, if I may, but Judge Conley.
No, go right ahead, Judge Essen.
Okay. Looking at the spousal maintenance, and to some degree, perhaps this is also a question on the assets, the Wells Fargo account and the quote, omitted assets, whatever that means. What are you asking this court to do? I mean, I understand your arguments, like with spousal maintenance. Well, the court didn't specifically address the need or the cost or financial, you know, outcomes of planned education. Are you asking us to remand this and say, go back and on the record that's already there, make more specific findings, or are you saying that we should give the district court the ability to reopen the record? I just want to understand with those two issues, what are you asking us to do?
On the issue of spousal support, we would request that the court's order simply be reversed.
So that there would be no spousal maintenance?
No spousal maintenance. The court made a fundamental error in terms of the burden of proof, said that appellant had the burden of proof when very clearly under Dobrin, the respondent had that burden of proof. In addition, the evidence just was not presented. This isn't a case of a remand. It's not there. She didn't support her budget. even her paid expert didn't have underlying documents. It was all what she said.
And turning to what these two omitted assets, what would you ask us to do there?
I believe that issue would either need to be remanded so that the court could consider what an equitable division would be. In the case of a reversal, I think that's a harder argument to make because there are omissions here that need to be dealt with. And so to me, that's more of a remand issue than a reversal.
A remand and open the record? Or are you saying, well, look, they both testified, that just the district court needed to make a decision?
I think the court needs to make a decision. The court already found with respect to the diamond that respondent, again, was not credible. The facts surrounding the secreting of the $45,000 are the same. It involves the same likelihood that they were hidden in the safe, and the court needs to address that. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Arnold. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Susan Gallagher, and I represent the respondent, Hannah Mekkonen, in this matter. Let me begin by saying I think you all have seen many high conflict cases in front of you, and I think this is a great example of those types of cases where there was conflict from the get-go. Right out of the very first motion for temporary relief advanced by Mr. Versabo, he began his complaints that my client was mentally ill, that she was promiscuous, that she was a gold digger, that she was endangering the child. As soon as the court issued an order, the order was disrespected. There's another motion or a letter. It was a constant deluge of the court didn't get it right. Now I'm going to have to proceed with this. The court didn't get it right. Now I'm going to have to proceed with under very limited claims like Liu cried inconsolably for 10 minutes, so that must mean she was endangered by mother. So this is the type of things that were recurring, and I don't know if some of it felt like it was unsophisticated arguments, and some of it just felt like it was trying to advance a position, which is what I believe the court found throughout these proceedings, that Mr. Versabo adopted a position, and his position was correct, and his is the only position that should be considered. And I believe that's what we're seeing here, and it goes to whether or not the child should attend kindergarten, and then his backdoor attempt to try and get the child into kindergarten once the court had issued an order. So we're seeing those sorts of difficulties with
his
case.
Speaking for myself only and not my treasured colleagues, you know, it seems like the findings on the custody were very detailed and, you know, went through all, you know, 1 through 12. Whereas, I understand generally the maintenance decision. I didn't see the analysis you're supposed to do in order to grant the temporary maintenance for 3 years. So am I wrong?
I think it was there, Your Honor. I think it was throughout the decision that was issued by the court. For example, the age of the parties, her education, his opinion.
Well, I didn't see a budget. I mean, I didn't really see
her budget. I know he's not referenced. It was in the underlying information that was provided to the court. I know he didn't reference it in his.
I have no doubt you supplied it. You're an excellent attorney, as is Ms. Arnold. But, I mean, the court's got to go through the budget and say yes, yes, no, split the difference in the middle, dry cleaning too high, car okay, I didn't see that, and that's.
It's true. That wasn't there, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if that's a reversible error, then it has to be reversed.
What about the property division, the diamond and the Wells Fargo account? I have a little, speaking again for myself, I have some concerns about that as well.
Well, the Wells Fargo account's an interesting situation. It was her non-marital account prior to the party's marriage. She testified that the day...
Is that true? I mean, I'm not so sure.
It was an account that was in her name prior to the marriage. Mr. Versabo made no claim on it. And what the testimony about the $45,117 is, they went to the bank and they withdrew the funds, and he asked for cash, and she gave it to him, and he used it for repairs on the homestead. Yes, there was, you know, I suppose we could have spent much more time trying to do discovery, trying to analyze where this $45,117 was spent. I think we believed it was gone. I believed my client that she gave it to Mr. Versabo and it was gone. The court I know did not address it. I think the court believed it was gone as well, and it was a non-factor in this situation, like many issues that were raised repeatedly. On the issue of the diamond, it is kind of one of those things, again, there was a huge component of the diamond that was non-marital, about $12,000 worth of the diamond. It was never recognized by Mr. Versabo that that was a valid claim. And so the remaining value of that diamond, about $7,000 of it, was marital and subject to a division. And I think, you know, I don't think the court could have, I think the court could have made more detailed findings as to the property division. There was an attachment, there was a table attached, he could have spent more time on it. I agree that he could have. I think he did find that there was an equitable division of the marital property, and that if you look at the tables that were advanced by the court, I think that it is set out in there. And I agree, $45,117 isn't in there. And I agree that there could have been more detail about the diamond. I think if this is the basis for a reversal, then I think obviously it must be reversed. I think it's a very small issue in the big picture of this.
Gallagher,
this
follow
case.
Up, and it was Judge Jessen's question. It sounds like if we conclude that it is, you're believing the record wouldn't have to be reopened. The judge has failed to make some findings, and so on the existing record, the court could make those findings.
I agree. I think that's exactly right, Judge Slater. I think that's correct. I think there was sufficient record. You know, we had 5 days of trial. It was an extensive trial with lots of testimony from various people. And the majority of the testimony in this trial was relative to custody and parenting time. And then a whole lot of testimony by Mr. Versabo's witnesses trying to, you know, talk about my client's credibility issues in the criminal matter that were not applicable by the court, and the court did not take those issues and analyze them in relationship to custody because it wasn't related to custody. You know, and the custody determinations about credibility really were that appellant had repeatedly made, you know, false claims and involved the police and exposed the client and argued about parental alienation. And when the custody evaluator said that there were behaviors that were consistent with parental alienation, which was her testimony, but there was no parental alienation, he still doesn't want to believe it. So, it must be true.
Ms. Gallagher, if I can go back.
Yes.
So Ms. Arnold said, you know, because the district court did rely, I think, on these 17 calls. In, you know, if you read that the decision that comes through loud and clear, that there weren't 17 calls, that would be clearly erroneous. I mean, what does the record say about that?
The record, you know, Your Honor, my recollection is that there were 17 calls to the police, and some of those were related to calls that he made to CPS that went to the police that he was then involved in those calls. That's my recollection. I don't think I'm wrong about it. I suppose I could be because I'm, you know, I could be, and it's a big record. But he also did many other things that were disruptive. Even in his reply brief, he says, I didn't keep the kids for 5 days. He has a responsive brief, I believe it was in May of 2020, I think that's 5/18/2020, he admitted that he'd kept the children for several days, including a whole day where we ended up involving the court and asking, you know, having the court return the child. And this is all because she's mentally ill, and I know your patterns, and you're unstable, and maybe you should do some yoga, right? So it's. I think in many respects, and I think the court could have been more distinct about it, about saying Mr. Versabo just refused to believe what the other evidence in this case purported. And he wanted to believe only his evidence, and that's what everybody else should believe. And I think it was a, It was a recurring issue throughout this. He just wouldn't believe anything. He was right, and that had to be what it is, Your Honor. So I think that's what I
Ms. Gallagher, you also have two motions, which Judge Siegel indicated the panel will be addressing. So one of them deals with the motion to strike. I'd like to focus a little bit on the attorney's fees, the need-based attorney's fees for the appeal. Okay. So if we conclude that, there are issues with the findings and the support for the maintenance, and there are issues with the property division, and that's got to go back, you know, there's sort of two ways we can handle the attorney's fees. We can say, well, we can assume that, you know, the court's going to make the findings and therefore the maintenance is going to be what it is, and the division may or may not make your client a little worse off, which would, of course, affect, you know, her needs for the need-based fees. And so we could say, well, you know, the court can sort all that out. The Supreme Court doesn't seem to like that. And they would prefer, well, based on my reading, that we deal with the attorney's fees because they relate to the appeal. Mm-hmm. What is your preference on that? Would you just have us deal with the attorney's fees, even though theoretically the need might be proven to be stronger if it goes back and there are, you know, tinkerings with the property divisions? Or would you just rather us make the call and, you know, resolve that and be done with that?
Well, Judge Connelly, I have a hard time saying that we shouldn't abide by what the Supreme Court wants you to do. That's my first kind of response to that. You know, so if that's what I'm sure it's more than an inkling is. I'm sure that that's what you believe should happen, then I think that's what should happen. I think you should follow your judgment on that. I think the issue, I'm sure you know that I've represented her through Volunteer Lawyers Network, and my hours were over 700 hours in representing her in this case. It was an inordinate amount of time. I just couldn't continue to do that in this particular proceeding, but we thought it was financially advantageous for her that I would continue. So I think it would be best if you make the decision, and I think it would be helpful if you did, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Gallagher. That does provide us some guidance.
Thank you.
Ms. Arnold, you'll have the last word.
Thank you. This case is not just a high conflict case. One problem with the term high conflict is sometimes it leads parties to ignore the underlying facts of the case. In this case, my client was adamant about certain things that he was right about. This case started based upon false allegations of abuse. During the pendency of this proceeding, my client had the weight of criminal charges over his shoulders that not only did he face criminal charges, he faced deportation. Abuse of discretion happens under Weatherly, under Rogge, when there is a double standard that is applied and when material facts are omitted. This court's emphasis on the 17 calls, which we would submit aren't correct, ignores the other side, ignores the false allegations of abuse. And when my client is making calls, there are problems. He's dealing with a child who is calling him stupid, psychopath, alcoholic, you stole all our money. He is dealing with situations where mom is actively interfering with any communications he has with the child when he can see that she's being manipulated against him. The testimony of Emmanuel Hardy, for example, ignored. My client ended up having those criminal charges dismissed because he stayed true to the truth in this case. This is not just a high conflict case. This is a case where it is critical that the court look at the evidence. Diane Reller's custody recommendations, well, she says there's compelling evidence of domestic abuse. After the OFP, respondent claimed he broke her teeth several times previously, forgot to mention in the OFP trial. She claimed that he also happened to have raped her to try to abort the baby, forgot that at the OFP. These are big, dangerous claims. My client may have called the police. My client may have called CPS to address concerns. That's what they're for. He's not from here, too. So he doesn't know the ins and outs of the system here. English isn't his first language. He did what he felt that he had to do.
You know, Ms. Arnold, and I do apologize because this is important, and perhaps I've missed it. On the 17 calls, I don't recall seeing anything in your brief specifically challenging that as an erroneous finding. Am I wrong?
I think there's a reference in there to it being seven or eight calls.
All right, I will look for that. Thank
you.
If
the court wants to look at some critical exhibits, there was the claim, for example, the 911 call. Diane Reller was concerned that Dad had made a claim that Mom was out and she had possibly a knife in her hand. Respondent's version of that case, of that situation, was that he tried to stop her from leaving the house and was trying to take off her shoes. My client, because he was so afraid of the chronic false statements, if he didn't have a third party with him, he was recording. He recorded that 911 call. He was hidden in a closet. She said, "I'm going," and she left. That's what actually happened. And so this is not high conflict. These are serious issues that needed to be addressed by the district court. And the district court had more information than the custody evaluator. The court cannot just rest on a custody evaluation because what happens at trial matters. When evidence is impeached, it matters. When the custody evaluator relies on information that's not true, and these are the judge's credibility determinations, right? This isn't just his argument. This is a 911 recording that says what she said wasn't true. And while this may seem to be a side issue on the issue of credibility, please look at the testimony of Detective Hooper. She was charged with criminal fraud. Recorded conversation with the detective. She lied to the detective at trial. When she's being impeached, she starts saying that appellant was sitting next to her, forcing her to say what she said to the detective. We, like that, had to produce proof. No, he was on a business trip. He wasn't even there. This is dangerous behavior that impacts a child, that impacts legal custody, and it is error to ignore it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Arnold. Thank you very much, Ms. Gallagher. The matter is submitted. We will be issuing our decision within 90 days.